Okay, cool. All right. So good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are, and thanks for having me. So Max asked me if I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things I'd been blogging about. And so that's what I'll try to do. I've never done this as a presentation, so bear with me, and we'll see how it goes. So we're going to talk about Linux networking and some of the terms that you may have seen fly by on the blogs and the Twitters, and maybe even work with a little bit yourself. So a little bit about me. So I'm based out of Vancouver. My name's Andre, and I like tinkering with technology, mostly network related type stuff, sort of bleeding over into the sysinch type thingies. I know most of you on this call through something I did earlier with BGPmon. I used to work at Cisco, recently left there and taking a bit of a break, and hope to focus maybe a little bit more on my blogging things. So what are we going to talk about today? So we're going to talk about Linux kernel networking, DPDK, VPP, XDP, and eBPF. And so these are all pretty big topics, and the goal is to demystify these technologies a little bit. So maybe a word about this presentation. So this presentation is really a summary of about four blog posts that I did. You can find on my website, tunc.io. And I'm going to try and sort of summarize my experience and learnings along the way. I think, given the audience here, that my background is probably very similar as many of yours. So I'm coming at this very much as a network engineer. I should also stress that I am not a kernel developer, nor am I a C programmer. So I can fiddle around a little bit, but I'm certainly not an expert. So I'm really just kind of reporting my observations, my journeys, and my learnings from a network engineering perspective. All right, so let's get started. So the background typically is we've heard through the grapevine for about DPDK and userland networking, and we should kernel bypass because it's slow and so on and so forth. How slow is slow? So, I started out this journey with like, I want to play with these technologies so that I can experiment with it and get familiar with it, and see if it's really that much faster than, say, the Linux kernel. But to do that, I needed a reliable way to first generate and measure traffic. And so I wanted something like an Ixia or something like that. But a lot of my testing was done in the cloud on Amazon, or I ended up using Packet.com, which is now Equinix Bare Metal, quite a bit. And yeah, you can't just ship an Ixia there. And since this was all on personal, I don't have money next year, I'm willing to spend money on that. So as a real network engineer, I started out doing lots of iperfs. But I quickly discovered that if you want to measure millions of packets per second, iperf wasn't really going to cut it, at least not for me. And I really wanted to measure millions of packets per second because I wanted to get into this, as if it was a router, essentially. So I needed a different way. So then I started looking at DPDK packet gen, which is eventually what I settled on. And say that is basically a DPDK application that allows you to do really fast send and receive packets. And so we talk a little bit more about what DPDK is in a little bit, this is an example application. And so what this does is it's a tool. It allows you with a CLI to basically set, hey, I want to generate this many packets from this IP address to this set of destination IPs with these ports and protocols and so on and so forth. You can also program it using Lua, which is a scripting language, or PCAPS, which is replay PCAPS. So, anyways, at the end of this, I had a traffic generator, and that is the end of the first blog post. And you can find the details here, including a whole bunch of example scripts. So this is kind of what that looks like. Sort of on the right-hand side is the output of the packet generator. Yeah, let's so move on. So now that we have a reliable way to test performance, we can have the games begin and really start playing around with the Linux kernel, which is what I wanted to start with first. So even though I told you this in like 5 minutes, even getting this packet generator going and all that research took me quite a bit of time. I will say there's one other package generator that I find was worth playing with that I played with later on, which is called Cisco's T-Rex, which is an open source package generator as well. It's actually a little bit more advanced and is worth playing with as well. All right, so let's move on then. So now that we're good to measure passive, we can do full line rate, 14 million, 28 million packets per second. We can start measuring. And so the first thing I wanted to know is how fast or slow is the Linux kernel? And so I rented these fairly heavy duty machines at packet.com. So these are 2.3 gigahertz Intel Xeon processors that can go up to 3 gigahertz. They have two sockets, and each CPU socket has 16 cores with two threads each. So in total, I was working with 64 cores essentially with hyperthreading enabled. So heavy duty machine. It also came with a quad port Intel X710 NIC, so 4 times 10 gig, which is pretty heavy duty as well. And so keep a good eye on the picture on the right, because that's what we're going to use in various tests going forward. So on the left hand side, you have the traffic generator, which is what's running DPDK packet gen with two ports. So on the top, you see DPDK port 0. That has a 10 gig port going to the device on the test, or the DUT, right? That's really the device that we're testing, which in this case is the Linux, just a vanilla Linux machine, which is going to route that traffic out from ENO2 to ENO4, and then it arrives back at DPDK port 1 on the traffic generator. And if I'm sending 10 million packets per second out of DPDK port 0, I'm expecting 10 million packets back on DPDK port 1. And at the same time, I'm looking on the device on the test just to see what is the what am I seeing on that device? What's the CPU load? How many cores am I using? And so on and so forth. So the device on the test in this scenario is a standard Ubuntu 18 LTS release with a 5.0 kernel. And I only really changed two things. So the first thing I changed was this eth tool command that you see on the left. So basically, all you're doing there is giving the NICs a little bit larger receive buffers. So again, I'm going to try and max it out with 14 million packets per second. So you need to give it a little bit more breathing room. And the only other thing I enabled was the sysctl to enable IP forwarding. And so for the rest, this is all base Linux stuff. All right, so now that we have a good idea of what we're testing, let's take a look at some of the results. So there's a lot of data here, and the best thing to look at is the first table, the top table, and then the line that says one direction. So sort of the first line. So every test, I'm testing many flows and I'm testing a single flow. And the single flow performance is important. And I'm gonna pull back a little bit why that is important. So CPUs are not necessarily getting a whole lot faster anymore. Instead, what you're seeing is that the vendors are putting more cores and even more sockets into a chassis. And so the idea is that we start doing more multi-threading and multi-core architectures, right? And so the question then becomes, how does this work for networking? If I'm sending you a million packets per second, how is that being load balanced over the cores? And so the way that works is there's the concept of receive queues, a number of queues. And if you spin up a typical, say, DigitalOcean VM with 4 cores, it typically comes with 4 receive queues. So typically you have as many receive queues as you have cores. And that is because typically every receive queue has an interrupt handler, which is served by a dedicated core or CPU, and you can even pin it to that. So if you have, say, 10 CPUs, but only one receive queue, you will never be using more than one CPU for network traffic. So you want to have typically as many queues as you have CPUs. So then the question is, how does the kernel determine on which queue traffic ends up to? And that's, as network engineers, is very similar as you're used to with ECMP or LAGS. It's just a 5-tuple hash. And then depending on the number of queues, that's where the traffic ends up on. So that's why it's important that I test with one flow only as well, because that basically is one flow will also always end up on the same queue, which is always served by the same interrupt handler, which is always served by one core only, or it can only go as fast as one core. So that will give you the performance, the network performance of a single core. All right. And why is that important? Well, this is important if you do things like what we call elephant flows. So for example, I spend a lot of time on building IPsec gateways using Linux. And one of the challenges that we had is IPsec is one big flow. And even though there's many other flows in there, and so you can only go typically, and there's ways around it, but typically as fast as how fast one flow can go. So in this scenario, one flow was about 1.4 million packets per second. And again, throughout this whole presentation, I'll be talking about packets per second, not as much about bytes or bits per second, because in the world of Linux in general, it's mostly around how many interrupts you press, and it really matter how many bytes are in the packet. Okay? So 1.4 million packets per second per core, and then you can sort of start extrapolating that a little bit. It gives you a good sense of sort of your budget. Okay, then look at the last line. So now I'm using bidirectional 10,000 flows on both DPDK ports, sending 10,000 flows. And I was trying to max it out at 14 million packets per second, which is 10 gig line rate at the lowest packet size. But I didn't quite get there, but I got about 12 million per direction, 24 million in total. And I needed 26 cores for that. So, you know, if you wanted to build a 10 gig peering router using Linux, you'd need roughly 26 to 30 cores to make that work. Right, so that's kind of our baseline now. Now we know how fast we can go. So that's just regular forwarding. Then just for fun, I enabled contract. And if you look at the last line in that table, the contract really gets interesting when you have many flows bidirectional. And you can see it's almost double the budget that you need. I needed all of a sudden 53 cores to do the same bidirectional full rate test. So 53 is a lot of cores, man. So you could see that even though you might be able to do that with Linux today, as soon as you go to 25 gigs or 40 gigs or even 100, that kind of stops with the number of CPUs you typically see in a machine. The blog post also has numbers around NAT. I probably won't have time for that here, but if you're interested in NAT, those numbers are even worse. Okay, just for fun, if you ever log into a machine and you see this basically means it's fully maxed out doing network traffic. So you ended up in what we call IRQ hell. So you see all these ksoft IRQs. So that's basically the kernel reading data off the network queues, right? And in this case, all the cores are doing this soft IRQ work. So this is interesting. I certainly logged in once or twice to a production system where I saw some of these threads doing this. And that basically means you're receiving too much traffic and probably are under some kind of DDoS. And a very interesting little side fact is because we just talked about the number of flows and how it works with receive queues. So if someone is attacking you or you, then it's actually better for that attacker to, and he only has a budget of say 5 million packets. It's better to put those 5 million maybe in two or three flows as an attacker, because those will guarantee pack the one or two CPUs versus having many flows, because then it gets load balanced very nicely. So don't share this with the attackers, but that's an interesting side fact. All right, so that's the end of blog number two. So now we have a baseline of the performance of Linux networking and the kernel. So then it's time to go a little bit deeper and talk about kernel bypass networking and DPDK or userland networking. So these are all the terms that kind of are the same thing. But the principle of userland networking is that you essentially take the networking stack away from the kernel and have it dealt with a userland program. And DPDK is a userland NIC driver. And so what does that mean? Well, once you start using DPDK, it comes with some utilities. And a typical utility that you use is you basically type in something like DPDK bind port or whatever, and you tell the kernel, you give it a PCI slot, and you say, this PCI slot, this NIC, network interface card, is no longer yours. You can ignore it, release it. And then you give it to DPDK. And then DPDK now takes ownership of that NIC and becomes the driver of that. And that's pretty important to realize. And that's one of the big lessons I learned when I started playing with that. It literally means that the NIC or the kernel no longer sees the network interface card. Right? If you do IP link or ifconfig, it's gone. If you wanted to do TCP dump on that NIC, it's gone. If you wanted to do IP tables or bind in IP addresses on it, it's gone. Even worse, if you think, oh, I've heard DPDK is fast, and I'm going to run my Nginx proxies or whatever using dbdk, that won't really work because Nginx and any other program or even SSH needs a socket to bind on. And it leverages the kernel to make socket programming happen. Well, with dbdk, it's just a driver. And so now you need user land alternatives to do a lot of what the kernel did for you before. Okay. One other thing to know is dbdk is a very fast driver. And one of the reasons why it's fast, it's bypassing a lot of the code in the kernel. But the other big difference is you might see the term PMD, which basically stands for pull mode driver, which is the opposite of what we saw in this picture, which is interrupt driven, lots of IRQs. So once you start a dbdk program, you typically give it one or two CPUs per NIC or something like that. And what happens if you then run top, you see those processes spinning at 100% all the time or 99% all the time, whether there's traffic or not. And so basically what happens is that this dbdk driver is constantly pulling for traffic. Is there a packet? Is there a packet? Is there a packet? So it's not very efficient, but it's super fast, and it certainly gives you a lot of these advantages. And if you have many cores, and you know you only start using dbdk when you're really building network specific applications, typically it's probably fine to dedicate a few NICs to that. All right, so dbdk is a very fast driver. It's very good at sending and receiving traffic really fast, but that's it, right? And so now you need something on top of that that takes the packets that dbdk puts in memory and does something with that. And so the first application that we looked at was packet gen, which is basically generating the packets and receiving them and printing some statistics. But that's useful if you want to do packet generation. But when you want to build maybe, and in my case, that's always what I have in mind, I want to build a virtual router or a router using Linux, I need something that is doing forwarding between the two dbdk NICs in this case, right? And so you need a user land program that can work with dbdk. So one common example is Open vSwitch. So a lot of folks use that, for example, for hypervisor networking. It is mostly focused on layer two networking. So the thing that I was playing with is something called VPP, which is part of the FD.io open source project by Cisco. So VPP is a technology that has been living in Cisco for I think close to two decades now, and they recently open sourced it, and it's pretty remarkable piece of software. So basically it's an open source data plane, and it's very good in forwarding packets between network cards. And it can do tunneling protocols, it can do NATing, and it has quite a bit of functionality. So that's what I'm using to do some of these tests. So maybe one more thing about VPP. VPP is really it has a FIP, it has a forwarding plane. So you can think of it as a router line card where dbdk are the ports, and then VPP is the line card, it's the FIP. It can switch really fast between ports, but it doesn't have a control plane. It has APIs and has a CLI, and you can program the FIP, but it doesn't come with something like, say, BGP or something like that. So that is something you'll have to do yourself. Okay, so let's take a look at the numbers. So a lot of talking about what dbdk is. So here are the results. So the one direction, one flow test, you see 8.6 million packets per second. So that's already almost, you know, what is it, 7 or 8 times as fast as the Linux kernel. And if we look at the last line, the bidirectional 10,000 flows, we actually did get to the 28 million packets per second. And I only needed 3 cores. That's insane. Like the other machine was full of soft IRQs and shit. And I'm here, I'm only using 3 cores. So that's 10 times as fast. So if you look at the summary, it's super fast and does cheap. And by cheap, I mean, if you're building virtual network functions like firewalls or IDSs or whatever, you have a lot more cores to actually inspect the traffic and do packet recognition and all that kind of stuff. So your budget is now a lot bigger. VPP is plugin driven, so you could, in theory, build your own packet processor without the need to make any kernel changes or all that kind of stuff. And so it's pretty cool. You can experiment with that. But it's all written in C, so depending on your skill set there, you might need to level up a little bit. But pretty interesting, and the numbers are amazing. Now the cons, yeah, you do need dedicated NICs for dbdk typically, unless you use SRIOV where you create virtual NICs. You lose all kernel network functionality. So in my case, I needed to have this, the test machines that I was using had 4 10 gig NICs, And I needed one at least for management so I could SSH into it, because I'm losing the mix if you use DPDK. And then finally, so you don't get socket programming, you don't get IP tables, you don't get NetFilter. You have to re-implement all of that or find tools such as VPP or Open vSwitch to do some of that. And then finally, Open vSwitch really is only a FIP, but it doesn't really have a control plane. It has APIs to build one, but it doesn't come out of the box with one. All right, so that's the end of blog number three. Hopefully this gives you a little bit of a better idea what DPDK is and what VPP is. And then finally, I wanted to look into XDP and eBPF. I've heard quite a bit of about this, but to be honest, I had no idea what this really was. So again, I spent quite a bit of time, many weeks, learning about what is BPF. And yeah, it is indeed the same thing that you're used to with TCP dump, but this is the enhanced version. So it evolved over many years. And I've heard someone explain to me what JavaScript was to the web is what eBPF is to the kernel. So what is it? So eBPF essentially is a little program that you can write in C or Go or whatever, and then you compile it as bytecode, and it ends up being a very small VM, not the same VM that we're used to, but a very small executable. And it has some limitations in what you can do. And then this executable, this VM, is executed by the kernel each time it reaches one of the kernel hook points that you've attached to. And so there's multiple hook points that you can connect these programs to. And every time the kernel reaches one of these hook points, says, oh yeah, no, I should execute this little eBPF program. And then you can do things. So you can, a lot of people use it for telemetry and so on and so forth. And so XDP is a special, is the hook point for the Linux networking stack. It sits very early on in the receive path of the kernel, and it allows you to have a user-supplied eBPF program decide the fate of the packet. And so literally what happens, you attach this BPF program typically to the driver. So as soon as it comes out of the driver, but before, and this is important, an SKB is created. So an SKB is a socket object in the Linux kernel, and it gives you lots of functionality. But from there on, it gets a little bit more expensive. So it happens before that. You have access to the raw packet. And so that's kind of what XDP is. And it really strikes a balance between this kernel bypass, but also still getting a lot of performance. So let's take a look at this thing. Yeah, so where does XDP sit? So this is sort of an example of the Linux network stack. So you have the NIC at the bottom, and then you have XDP, and then you go to TC, traffic control, NetFilter, TCP, and the sockets, right? And as you go up the stack, you get more functionality, more abstraction. It tends to be a little bit easier to work with, but you also go through a few thousand lines more of code every layer, and it gets a little bit slower. And so some of you might have, for example, used TC in the past because maybe IP tables was too slow to drop something really quickly in terms of DDoSes or something like that. Well, XDP sits even lower, so you can attach it there. So you write this XDP program, and once it gets executed on every packet, you basically get access to the packet, some pointers, and you can parse the packet. And then you can read it, you can modify it, you can update some counters, and eventually you need to exit the program. And you do that by returning any of these five actions. So we'll talk about that very quickly. So you have XDP drop, which is basically, okay, I looked at it, I want to drop the packet, which is typically used for if you want to build an XDP firewall or for DDoS mitigation scenarios, so you can really cheaply drop these packets. XDP abort is also a drop action, but typically used when your XDP program crashes or freaks out, so it's not something you use typically. XDP pass is, I took a look at this packet and I like it, and I want to pass it along to the kernel, whether it be modified or not. So this is important, right? If you look at this diagram again, the goal is typically for it to go up to the kernel. So XDP pass basically means I'm handing it off to TC and then NetFilter and so on and so forth. XDP TX basically means I'm going to send this packet straight out the same interface that it came in on. So this is a typical use case for the one-legged load balancer, where you typically maybe rewrite the destination MAC address or IP address so that it ends up at the right origin, or even put it in a tunnel, but then you send it out the same interface. And then the last action is the one that we're going to use going forward, which is actually redirect, which is Black Sway. You can redirect it to using AF Axiv to potentially something else we won't talk about, but also to a different NIC. And that's really interesting because we have two NICs and we want to build a 10 gig capable peering router with two NICs. And I want to be able to redirect between the two NICs. And that's what we're going to use. And so in all of this, you have the ability to update some counters if you want. You can modify the packet and then exit with any of these codes. Okay, you remember with DBDK and VPP, I hammered a little bit on that. You know, it's really only a FIP. And it's hard because now you have to program that FIP using your own CLI commands or APIs. So XDP has a really interesting feature because it's still part of Linux, really. And with XDP, we have access to certain kernel tables, including the FIP or the routing table, which is basically the table that you see when you type in IP route show or net.stop.rn. And we can use that using this function called BPF FIP lookup. And the parameters are typically something like, this was the input interface, this is the source IP, this is the destination IP, and even some more protocol specific information. And that will return a next hop interface index number. And it's doing that based on what's in the Linux routing table or forwarding table. So what's the big deal? Well, the big deal here is that you solve the control plane problem. So now you can just run BERT or FRR or put in static routes into Linux just the way you were used to, or maybe that we were doing in the first or the second blog post. But you get the speed advantage of XDP. And if we think about this as a typical router, XDP are now sort of the ports on the blade, and Linux is our routing engine. And we have the ability to communicate between the two, which is really, really quite interesting. Okay, enough talking. Let's talk about some performance numbers here. So again, the same one direction, one flow. We can see I need one core for about 4.6 million packets per second. So it's about four times as fast as the Linux kernel. And then the last line, the 14 million or 28 million bidirectional tests with 10,000 flows, I needed five cores, which again is a significant improvement over Linux, a little bit slower than VPP. But it does strike a really nice balance between the two. So let's take a look at some of my lab setup here. So there's a lot here, but I'll walk you through it. So the top left is the output of the packet generator. So you can see port 0 and port 1 in the vertical columns. And you can see that both of these ports are sending and receiving at 14 million packets per second. And then the bottom left is the device under test, the XDP router. And this little program is basically printing the statistics of the XDP actions every second. And you can see in this case that that we're exiting with XDP redirect 14 million times per second, so 14 packets per second. And then I ran a top on that same machine. You can see four cores are maxed out, and then a few are doing a little bit extra. So in total, I needed about five cores. You can also see that this machine had nine receive queues, which I didn't actually have to use all of them. Which is pretty good. And then at the same time, you can see my BERT output. I was running it with a full table because one of the things I wanted to know is does it have any effect on the FIP lookup call if the table is, you know, if it's a very large table. So it was 800K routes. I was even filtering RPKI invalids like a real router. And now we had built a full peering router and we need about five cores only to do this. Okay. So now we walked through all four blog posts. We talked about building a packet generator, and then we started looking at the baseline Linux, and then we looked at DBDK and XDP for potential improvements. We saw that for Linux to do full 10 gig line rate between two NICs in all directions, you needed about 30 cores, if you could even get there. It does give us great flexibility, lots of features such as socket programming, which you just kind of take for granted maybe, IP tables, stateful firewalling, and all that kind of stuff. And it's really optimized for cost, general purpose, and a little bit of everything. Then we looked at the optimized version with DBDK and VPP, and we saw we only needed three cores to do the same thing, which is really amazing and really gives you a lot of budget to do other things on this machine. Or if you're building a hypervisor, and your clients or your tenants are doing a lot of networking, this might be pretty interesting because you're saving a lot of cores. So amazing performance. But things to know is you do lose the NIC from the kernel, which has some collateral, and you need to fix this up with other userland alternatives. So VPP is really a great forwarding plane, lots of features. I know some of those folks on the call here have done some things with NAT. I recommend reading my blog about that because it has some really stunning NAT performance as well, especially compared to the Linux kernel. So really optimized for performance. And then finally, XDP, 5 cores to do the same test. So significantly better than Linux, slightly worse than DPDK, but still excellent performance. And really it gets that because it does this early processing of packets before it hits the kernel. Interesting to know, though, if you do XDP redirect or even XDP drop like we were doing with the redirect function, that packet stays at the bottom layers. So if you want to troubleshoot and do TCP dumps or something, that won't actually work because TCP dump doesn't go low enough, right? So that's something to know. So it really executes codes really early on. You lose some of that visibility, which you may want to fix in XDP as well. But the best thing is you don't lose the NICs. You'd have access to the FIP tables. And it still is really a sort of the best of both worlds, in my opinion. So with that, we kind of walked through my adventures about learning Linux networking, XDP, VPP, and sort of had to build a packet generator. I hope this was interesting for you guys. Again, you can find all the details on my blog. And if you have any questions, shoot now or send me a tweet or an email or whatever if you want to learn more. With that, you can open up for questions.